could read the list from a box.
Someone talks of loss, then they fan a bit.
Someone makes a fist.
Someone knocks. Now there was a pause. Then they argue it.
This is Mae Brussell on tape 427. It's side number 2, February the 8th, 1980.
And the day, it's the pebble, not the stream. It's the ripple, not the sea, that is happening. Not the building, but the beam. Not the jarring, but the stone. Only comes the dream, and history.
Words that I just played from Pacific Overture remind me of these meetings described in the Abscam operation, as Stephen Sondheim has the intrigue of people selling out other people to their own benefit and profits. What appears as small, isolated, single events actually are shaping our lives and our history, and Abscam is that kind of event, like, as I say, the tapes at the Watergate Hotel, that is going to shape future history of this country, I believe. In the song, Stephen Sondheim says, it's the fragment, not the day. It's the pebble, not the stream. It's the ripple, not the sea, that is happening. Not the building, but the beam. Not the garden, but the stone. Only cups of tea and history and someone in a tree. The person in the tree, translated, is watching history being made by wheeling and dealing. In this case, there were cameras and microphones and recording equipment to take down history in the early days when Japan was taken over by the American businesses. They were witnessed making treaties by a young boy in a treehouse. But the idea is the same, that little events, little meetings of people are those things that change history. Following the New York Times article 2 days after my tape with you on the William Taub links to organized crime in the Vatican and the syndicate and CIA, the whole ball of wax, I got on the telephone and I first called Leslie Maitland, the writer for the New York Times that referred to these two valuable paintings 13 years ago, and asked her, could she find out the name of those paintings? This is the end of the week and she hasn't called me yet. I called her on Monday. I called the Justice Department, the Information Division, asked for the gentleman who was on evening television talking about the matter on Sunday and Monday, and they told me to go to the Criminal Division. I called Criminal Division, and they turned me over to Organized Crime. I called Mr. Webster's office, the director of the FBI, and they told me to go back to the Information Area. I called Mr. Civiletti in the Attorney General's office to get information. I called the New York Times writers in Washington, D.C., and then I called the local FBI office, I know the agent here, and said, if you can get the names of these oil paintings, I think I have some important information on this case. Now, that is like saying after the Watergate arrests, if you tell me one fact about these people, I'll give you information of who they are. The CIA, the FBI, the Justice Department didn't want information coming in about these Watergate defendants. They wanted to block off the sources of information, and they don't want any leads filling in to break this story wide open. My local FBI agent said that he would let me know about this case. I called radio station KGO. Sunday night, I talked to gentleman Ray Talaferro that Sunday night about the paintings. I talked to Bob Trebert during the week, and Jim Eason, yesterday afternoon, about the getting the names of the paintings to see if we can open this ball of wax. Maybe next week I will have something to report to you. Maybe you can call the various news media and find out what paintings that were stolen several years ago started the investigation. Now, that shouldn't be difficult to find out. That won't jeopardize the trials of these people. If a famous Picasso is taken, it would be reported the men who stole it, whether they took it or didn't take it, would depend upon their lawyers and a court of law. The fact that it was stolen and recovered or stolen and not recovered, it still has a title. And yet, for some reason or other, I can't get the name of the paintings, and I'm wondering if it connects in any way to the William Taub story. He certainly would have a reason to bring down this can of worms that he was involved in. They tried to kill him, and he's still alive. Maybe what he knows keeps him alive because he could further blackmail them. But maybe there are a group of people that felt it was time for this story to break, and it's been investigated for the last couple of years and growing momentum until it spread from Brooklyn and New Jersey, Atlantic City, Pennsylvania, Las Vegas, Miami, and Washington, D.C. So far, we know that one senator has been named and six members of the House of Representatives, but also the arrest story said that about 20 state officials are also being investigated in terms of this scam, and it's those 20 state officials whose names I can't get. I have a few, but not all of them, so maybe the listeners in New Jersey and in Pennsylvania and New York will come forward and mail me those, because the Western papers out here don't carry them. There's several people that are named. One back east is Angelo Arricchetti, Democratic mayor of Camden, New Jersey, who's also a state senator. Kenneth McDonald of Haddonfield, New Jersey, a Republican named at the New Jersey Casino Control Commission. And Senator Joseph Maressa of Blackwood, New Jersey. They also said that an undercover agent seeking land for gambling casinos was engaged with dealing with New Jersey officials, and that goes into Senator Williams and meetings in Florida and promises of a share of a mine, a titanium mine, if he would use influence to obtain government contracts. So now, some of the men involved, I won't list them all because you can get them in May, the newspapers that are out, and next week maybe I'll do a diagram or chart of some of them and their relationships to New Jersey the casinos and so forth, but some of these people are already willing to talk in exchange for security from prosecution. So you can imagine what a ball of wax this is if the gentleman from Long Island and Brooklyn or New Jersey and Pennsylvania begin to squeal about the kind of operations that were involved. As I say, stolen art and securities and a lot of other shenanigans. There are all kinds of deals that were being made. Representative Richard Kelly was on national television on the Brinkley Show, and he's the first gentleman who's come forward, and he's kind of the comic relief. He's acting like Tony Lasswitz at the time of Watergate. Most important witness of all that appeared before the Watergate committee was Tony Lasswitz, because a man of his description, identical height, weight, and New York accent, was seen with Arthur Bremer up in Michigan just before George Wallace was shot. And the description of Tony Lasswitz fit a gentleman who was seen departing from the assassination scene in Maryland when Wallace was shot. And he was at Chappaquiddick the night that Mary Jo Kopechne died and received large amounts of money from the White House for dirty tricks. But when he testified, he wasn't asked the right questions, and he was the comic relief. And I have a feeling that this Representative Kelly is the comic relief to make light of the investigations, as they said on the evening news this last week. If this is all that Congress has to offer, they should be fired for their incompetence, not for their crimes. But Mr. Kelly talked about meeting with a man named Gino, and they asked him why he didn't go to the FBI with his information, and he said, well, he was afraid of these thugs, and he was afraid of these people. He said they were tough criminal kinds of people, and the doorman or the servant was like a mobster doorman and a bouncer, and he knew that he was meeting with hard criminals. Well, these were actually FBI agents that he believed were hard criminals, and he said that they offered to rough up anyone he wanted or removed anyone he wanted, which is equal to saying that these offers meant I'd murder your opponents or silence anyone who knows about you. So they're offering him the services of murder by request or damaging another person, and he went ahead and took the $25,000 anyway and was mingling with those kind of people and hadn't informed the law enforcement about it. This gentleman from Florida, who was a circuit judge down there, Representative Kelly, was removed by impeachment earlier and was voted into office again to represent his state in the House of Representatives, and is taking money in his pockets and living out of the glove compartment or the filing cabinets, but is meeting with known hoodlums who will do him service later if he needs it, and he doesn't think that's important enough to tell anybody. Some of the meeting locations were interesting. Among them, there were many, but among them was the Barclay Hotel in Philadelphia, Twin Bridges in Marriott Hotel in the Washington suburbs, the Plaza Hotel in New York, and a condominium in Ventnor, New Jersey, near Atlantic City, near the boardwalk at the Mafia headquarters for the New Jersey operations now. The Plaza Hotel is where 1960 Robert Mayhew was meeting with Sam Giancana and John Rosselli and members of organized crime to perform the second marriage or the third or fourth of the Central Intelligence Agency with gangland figures to set up assassination teams. It'd be nice to know if the same room in Plaza Hotel or suite has been kept from 1960 up through 1980, if this has been a particular safe house or haven for crime people, a particular apartment through the years. Stranger things than that have happened, and the Plaza Hotel seemed a very convenient place to meet in 1960. And again, they were meeting again to compromise congressmen and work with organized crime and figures involved in the underworld. Now, the reason I call this the Vada scam or the Carter scam is that there has not yet been a good development of the links of Jimmy Carter to organized crime. He was heavily tied up his early career with Dr. Peter Byrne, who worked with the Drug Enforcement Agency with Richard Nixon, and then went on to Jimmy Carter and was forced to leave office because of writing prescriptions for somebody in another name and now works at the United Nations. Hamilton-Jordan connections have never been prosecuted, and they've been hushed up, the allegations of his coke connections in New York City, Club 54. The trial or investigation of Jimmy Carter's possible pressure to the Justice Department not to prosecute Vesco or extradite him, Robert Vesco, involved in $500 million swindle of the Security Exchange, his investment overseas operation, that has never been opened up. That's sitting to choke the Carter. There are links to that. The narcotic connections down with the Capricorn Records, Capricorn and Greg Allman in Atlanta, Georgia, have never been properly investigated, or the money that went into Jimmy Carter's nomination and escalation of his ascendancy to presidency. I don't think it's any coincidence that Rosalynn Carter was photographed with Jim Jones, who was into gun running and narcotics, or this Gracie, whose trial is going on right now, Gacy rather, in Chicago, the largest group of mass murders in the United States, linked to Polish organizations and the church in Illinois. And she was also photographed with several other characters. One was John Ellsworth. I did a tape on that back in December of this year, tape number 419. The mysterious connections of John Ellsworth, a member of organized crime and narcotics operations, photographed at the White House with the Carters. He was there socially when Begin and Sadat were signing the Middle East peace treaty, and his operation is linked to heroin markets and hashish and Mr. Arafat and Lebanon, a whole can of worms there. Also, the Carters were photographed with another character who was later killed in a very embarrassing situation, Mr. Eppolito, Eppolito. These Brooklyn mobsters were shot to death in early October of this last year, 1979, one of them was photographed with Rosalynn Carter in the White House and used a front, his Cities and Schools project that Mr. Ellsworth got started for Eppolito, that was a front for pornography, for a possibility of killing the Shah of Iran, for arming third world countries with CIA connections and laser guns and oil in Ghana, a ball of wax that involved the Carters' organized crime, and a front used the Catholic Church fronts in Brooklyn and in New York City as a cover for pornography and so forth. The real story of the Carter drug connections has not come out. How is it that Rosalynn Carter was with Jimmy Eppolito April 11, 1979 at a hotel luncheon at the Hilton Hotel, and that these $50 million hash investigations that were underway linked to these people and all their trafficking and so forth can't be discovered by the Secret Service and the people around the president. Why is the president and why is his wife drawn into these things unless they're forced to appear public with these people in order to lend some credibility to them because of possible investigations in the future? Just at the time that Rosalynn Carter went to Rome, to Vatican, to see the Pope, and that Pope came to the United States, was the time when the stories of the organized crime links of Michele Sindona in New York City and the Vatican Bank were breaking, and the connections of Vatican money that was invested with mobsters, again, in narcotics, organized crime. And these stories of the Gambino family linked to the Vatican that I've been putting on the tapes recently indicate that this arrest that has been taking place, or the investigation that's been taking place, could lead into all those areas that I've been talking about of the criminal element in the same cities we've been referring to in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Long Island, Florida, and Washington. On tape 414, November the 9th, I talked about the Vatican finances and recently particular witnesses that had been gunned down by the mafia that had information of the Vatican links to the Gambino family. That goes back to tape 414. I have many tapes on the Vatican, and recently I've been talking about their transferring of oil paintings and holding money of the Nazis and works of art of the Nazis, and questioning whether William Taub got his gift from the Vatican by way of Nazi confiscation from World War II. The question that remains is, what was stolen from William Taub in New York City 13 years ago, and what was stolen in New York City in the way of oil paintings that set off Abscam 13 years later, that this entire connection of organized crime, stolen security, stolen art, goes right to members of Congress and the House of Representatives. Oh, I was asked by one of the subscribers of the sources of information that the Shah of Iran or his sister were interested in organized crime or in drug traffic. There are books, and I'm trying to get the many sources I can to answer that question. One book, The Crown Cannibals, that I referred to a few weeks ago by Rezi Bahreini, has a quotation that I'll share with you about the Paul Levy Foundation, and also a report by an organization, MERIP. This was written up also in Time magazine, June 23rd, 1975, and there are several dates for sources of this information. It talks about November 17th, 1960, Geneva police arrested Princess Ashraf, that's the twin sister of the Shah of Iran, for being in possession of two suitcases containing $2 million worth of heroin. Time gave the story highly critical coverage, which evidently must have upset the Shah. Mike Wallace, quoting to the Shah from a piece in the Washington Post, read, "A wealthy Iranian businessman says not a truck can move anywhere in this country without a payoff going to Princess Ashraf." That's from Time, October 22, 1976. It also reported bribes paid to Prince Shahram. Time magazine, June 23, 1975, Northrop paid $705,000 to the Iranian Prince Shahram, that's the nephew of the Shah of Iran, a member of the imperial family, for services such as helping the company find a good Iranian architect. Northrop was part of a consortium that received a $200 million contract to build a telecommunication system in Iran. And as I say, Hart Morgan, representing ABC News and radio and TV, was on telephone from Iran to San Francisco radio and was talking about the narcotics traffic and the other business traffic, and that everything went through the hands of the twin sister of the Shah of Iran, and acknowledged on conversation on the air about the narcotics traffic. A very terrible thing happened this weekend, simultaneously with the breaking of the Abscam story on the East Coast, and I believe they are directly related to each other, and that was the seizing of the state penitentiary in New Mexico by the inmates. This is an example of the barbarian way that people had the potential they have to become, and what is coming in this country and how it's coming down. And if you think it's isolated to that state penitentiary, then ask yourself where the 100 or 200 missing people are that did the murders in Jonestown that are out as programmed assassins to kill again, and where are the 50 missing people from the New Mexico penitentiary? Are they out to kill again? Now, the thing that's so frightening about this is that there's certain people that I've watched move up into positions of power, and I keep using their names. There's in Germany when you had Goering and Goebbels and Himmler and Heydrich and these various Nazis working their way up, Canaris and so forth, into the system of the Nazi organization until they took power in the government. And I warned last November, tape 414, November the 9th, 1979, watch out for California violence and politics. Now, I didn't anticipate this would spread to New Mexico, but I anticipated these figures would become national someday. And I referred to the movement and appointment in San Francisco of Raymond Procunier as undersheriff, because Procunier, as I described on that tape and on the printed sheet, worked with the CIA, the FBI. He set up race violences. He set up prison riots in California. He was the daddy of the San Quentin 6 shootout, and George Jackson was killed with a gun brought in from the Los Angeles Police Department. He was head of the prison system, setting up the murder and later the trial of the Soledad brothers, the Marin shootout when Judge Haley was killed, and that's where Angela Davis was arrested. I wrote, "Look out for violence in San Francisco, the future center of the martial law plan." These men I felt would be teams of the future terrorist organizations. There's names that you must never forget in the East or West or Midwest or North. One is Evel Younger. The other is Ed Davis. Evel Younger used to be the district attorney in Los Angeles when Robert Kennedy was killed and went on to be the attorney general of the state of California. Ed Davis was chief of police in Los Angeles when Robert Kennedy was killed and set up the criminal conspiracy section of Los Angeles Police Department that was linked directly to the White House and the Pentagon and the CIA and the National Security Agency, and had organization that had the plans to kill Richard Nixon in 72. Charles Bates was head of the FBI, trained in London and Chicago, and Fred Hampton and Mark Clark were killed, was in Washington covering up the Watergate for the FBI, and then was in California responsible for the SLA escapade, counterintelligence operation of the Pentagon. Mike Kerb is now the assistant governor, acting under Jerry Brown, who's away all the time, and Kerb brags, it's in the media, I run the state. And Charles Gaines, who was chief of police in Oakland when the violence was coming down with the Black Panthers and the counterintelligence operations, then went to San Francisco, where there was so much violence and killings in Jonestown that involved the San Francisco police and the killing of the supervisor and the mayor of that city, that Gaines finally was removed. But we have a team here that will be national someday: Younger, Davis, Bates, Kerb, Procunier, and Gaines. Well, when the riots came down in New Mexico, in the prison, the first thing I saw in the newspaper was that January the 14th, less than 3 weeks before the rioting and violence came, there was an investigative report issued, and they had called in Ray Procunier from California. Procunier's report for New Mexico said that the first priority should make a prison, in quotes, safe from escape, stabbings, and riots. Yet it was Lewis Tackwood, who wrote the Glass House Tapes, who worked for the criminal conspiracy section of the Los Angeles Police Department, that said he was brought into the Department of Corrections in California to set up prison riots. He would come into prison, be in a cell with somebody, and they'd say, "What's your rap?" And he'd say, "I stole a car, I stole something." "How long are you serving?" "5 years." Then Tackwood would set up operations where the scapegoats or the people that the California authorities didn't like could be killed or kept in prison for life. Then, because of the violence, the prison was broken up, and someone would be sent to Folsom or Chino and dispersed among them. Tackwood, who then, when he got out, would get in a civilian suit and go back and work again for Squad 19 of the Los Angeles Police Department, or the Criminal Conspiracy Section of the Los Angeles Police Department. So 3 weeks after Ray Procunier visited this prison, which I titled him one of the most dangerous members of our society, of our so-called law enforcement society, the prison, had these riots. Now, what happened in that prison? It wasn't just food and general conditions. There was one goal in that prison. They were after the informers. The informers were in a special wing. And before this riot came, there had been bars in that prison to separate the main office or the control center. But the bars were removed and glass was put in, and they were told it was glass, it wouldn't break, and of course it broke. And these very sophisticated certain prisoners went directly to filing drawers, and that's important, to get the names of informers. Now, when you're trying to get drug links that possibly link to Robert Vesco or to Jimmy Carter, Atlanta, Georgia, or the Shah of Iran or Barry Goldwater in Arizona or the Vegas connections of organized crime and people that have done murders or squealed or witnesses to trials, these witnesses were in a protective custody. They were called like the snitches. The important people that make prosecutions possible were in what you call a protective section. So these men knew to go to the filing cabinets and look for the names, and they broke down the protective section, and they decapitated them. They put rods through their heads. They cut off the arms and legs or limbs. There was torture. There was gouging of eyeballs with electric soldering things. They said there were shootings. There were guns. There were iron rods. You name it. Mutilation of every person. This total affair, this riot there, was to clean out the informer's wing, whether there were 30 important informers or whether there were five, and they had to kill 30 to do it. They did it. Now, you may say, is it worth the establishment problem to build a $50 million prison again? Are these people worth that? Well, evidently, there is much more to this story than has come out yet. And I would say that buildings are very cheap, whether through bonds or tax money in New Mexico, they'll get it. But New Mexico is a state riddled with organized crime and murders and informers. And the true story of the Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico crime drug connections is not out. And I'll venture to say that some very important witnesses that were in those protective cells were wiped out. And the sole purpose, in fact, one newspaper article said the purpose of these riots was to get these informers. And they were not doing it just out of frenzy. They went specifically to filing cabinets to get the names and know which cells to go to get the guys. The facts are that 3 weeks after Pecunier was there, there were over 1,200 men in the prison, something like 1,238, and there were only 15 men on the staff at the time of the riot. When the tortures began at 8:30 in the morning on Saturday, people with binoculars were watching outside and knew that people had been decapitated and tortured, and yet nothing was done for 24 hours. They could have used a gas or chemical or spray to subdue everybody and come in, but they allowed these particular informers to be killed and tortured before they ventured to come in. Not a single guard was slain. All of them got out. So evidently they knew that something was going to come down, because it'd be impossible that a guard wasn't hurt. The men went to the files, as I said before, to get the list of the informers. The informers were all tucked into one place, identifiable, and every single one of them in that section was murdered. And like Jonestown, when 125 or more killers, assassins, departed, there were at least 50 that departed from New Mexico and are unaccountable. And the question is, were they dressed up provocateurs? Were they brought in and set up the violence and then left? Did they know which files to go to? Were they put in the cells to know which names to look for? And then they were able to sneak out, because some did get out there. And the point is that Lewis Tackwood said that the LAPD, the criminal conspiracy section, that Ed Davis and Younger and Pecunia and these people were setting up a Gestapo. And this certainly is Gestapo activity, this kind of brutality. And then to disperse these people in other places, they have promised strong prosecution for the people responsible, but yet some people are missing, and I'm sure they'll never show up to be prosecuted. Wednesday's newspaper, February the 6th, from Santa Fe, New Mexico, said authorities said 50 inmates were unaccounted for. They did not mean they should be presumed to be dead or missing, but they refused to identify them and tell you what they were doing there. I wonder how many of those future people will turn up later as informers, such as Tackwood, writing books or telling us about it. Because of so many stories breaking of drug connections from the White House, the Vatican, and all over the world, and because special informers are set in a protective cell, I fear that we will never be able to get the information that was in the heads of these people, and that there had to be some kind of a link, considering the people involved here that have other links in common. These events taking place this last Saturday, I believe, have some connection to each other. One of the values of taking these tapes is, when these events take place, to go back to the past sheets that I've given you and the past tapes and look it up and remember what I said about these people, because they will appear and reappear until we make them account for their actions, for what they're doing at the time that they're visible on the scene. Our time is up. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. You take care. There's plenty of news. I could fill the next tape for next week right now, but we'll take it as it comes and do the best we can, and I'll be with you next week, hopefully.